This is GeekSpeak, episode 20 of our 16th season. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. Good to see you. We also have Mr. Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer. Hey, Brian.
Howdy, Lyle.
And last but not least, Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, world traveler, programmer, and music geek.
Are you also a word traveler?
What would that mean? A punster?
I think Miles is more the punster.
Well, he's the pedant.
He is
the pedant punster.
Pedantic punster.
Nobody's nerfed.
I'm more the dad joke punster, I think.
Brian, kids?
Kids, yes. Yeah, those darn kids. Just remember, they are smarter than you.
Speaking of dad jokes.
Speaking of
I don't have kids, by the way.
So you're just getting ready.
Barely old enough.
I think my dad jokes are probably better than all the fathers in the room, which is all of you. But
well, I don't know about that.
Well, if you are a father, make sure that your child never gets your iPhone unlocked and can do anything on it. So I saw this on Twitter. It made me laugh so hard. I don't know if I can actually do this story. A kid decided to do, you know, on an iPhone, you can go in and do text replacements. It's a little known feature deep in the settings where you can
do that on a phone?
You can do that on a phone, yeah.
Wow.
It's built into the OS.
It's in the keyboard area.
Yeah.
And you basically can write down a few characters and then write down what that should be replaced.
Right. It's made to be a macro.
So like IIRC would expand to, if I remember correctly, or something. So you don't have to type it over and over and over.
So on my phone, I've set GS to be, when it expands, to be geek speak, uppercase G, uppercase S as one word, because I type that all the time.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Really cool.
So a kid got to do this on his parents' phone, and this is the conversation that ensued.
Oh, Miles and Brian, you guys going to act this out? Who's the kid?
Miles will be the kid.
That makes sense.
Hey, guys, can I throw a party tomorrow night?
Hell yes. Wait, I typed hell yes.
Really?
Hell yes.
Brian's lost it.
Brendan, she's trying to say where... Okay, I'm not going to do that one.
It just gets worse from there.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, he had the phrase no changed to hell yes. Every time you type no, it expanded to hell yes.
Yes, exactly.
It's gorgeous.
So anyways, it ends up with, thanks you guys, you're the best.
That's pretty clever. You'd have to let them have a party at that point.
Just for cleverness?
I don't think you would, actually.
When my kids are cleverer than me, I definitely do that.
Well,
I'll let them win.
If you're pranked, does that mean the prankster is cleverer than you? It just means that you had a moment of stupidity.
Means he left his phone unlocked.
Right,
which is
exactly.
Security no-no.
Security no-no.
I've also went ahead and replaced certain words, like the word rocket. If I ever type it, turns into the emoji rocket.
Oh, nice.
Just things that would be kind of fun, and I won't recognize that I'm doing it. It just happens.
So I have that on my work computer because, like, there's a particular project we're working on that has a really, really long, difficult to type name, and my fingers always stumble over it. So I made a macro for that.
And now you can do it on your phone.
It is. Yeah, I guess I can. I don't have an iPhone. This is probably on Android, though.
I bet it exists on Android, too.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Miles, tell me about John Oliver.
John Oliver is a wonderful comedian who's now found on HBO, his last week tonight.
It's a great program.
Yes.
And John Oliver, of course, got his fame from The Daily Show. He was a correspondent on that for years. He's the British John on The Daily Show. And he's been doing this HBO show for a while. He actually also does a podcast that I listen to forever. I love, and I'll get the name of it at some point today.
Well, he had a rant about science. Not the first time he's done so. He had another one a little while back about global warming. But I just wanted to point it out, and seeing the clip on YouTube is easy to look up if you don't have HBO. But it's a rant about science reporting, and it was just so astute.
Yeah.
And
I watched that episode. I thought it was really good.
That I want more people to see it, especially if you have that family member that says,
we all do.
I found the study, and it said that, you know, eating chocolate will make you live 5 years longer, or, you know, something to that effect. Or, you know, pineapple juice cures coughs. Or if you do not have any such person in your life, You are that person. Please stop doing that. That is not actual science. It talks about how we have this peer-reviewed science, but many times the science is not peer-reviewed. There's no money in it. There's no incentive for it.
Mm-hmm.
And also talking about the fact that news organizations love sensationalism because they get viewers, but that is the sensationalism is not necessarily accuracy with regard to research.
Absolutely. I agree that this talk he gave about science, I think it was a couple weeks ago's show, we'll link to the YouTube channel from geekspeak.org, so you can go ahead and listen to that, watch that one episode. His research and show is fantastic on this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Good
kudos. And if you're bad
in
geography, watch John Oliver's first season or second season?
I don't recall. I recently
he would always
up.
Bring up a map and talk about, and here's Yugoslavia, and even know that that was not Yugoslavia, because Yugoslavia doesn't even exist anymore.
And I always fall for those, because that's just, I don't know, I have a really bad lookup table for that stuff in my brain. It doesn't stick.
This is the wonderful thing about YouTube mashups and like remixing content, because I've seen a YouTube video where someone just took all the times he brought up a map and showed you a country and then said, yeah, but you don't even know what you're talking about, because that's the wrong country, which is a great gag he does every time you see a map. And they compacted that into one clip of every single time, which is wonderful use of mixing it up. Ben, you're going to talk about OkCupid because you're actually a developer for OkCupid, right?
No, I'm not a developer for OkCupid, but I tend to cover all the OkCupid stories because I made a Chrome extension for OkCupid, which makes it a bit easier to use. And I'll talk about that briefly in a second. But this story is about I don't know exactly what to call it, a data dump, a data breach, a data release. Basically, some Danish researchers scraped a whole bunch of information from OkCupid, which is a dating website, and released it.
Oh man!
As a data set.
So basically, everybody that had an account on OkCupid's data got lost into the wild.
Not lost into the wild. It was uploaded. Well, I mean, effectively, it was because it was uploaded somewhere else. It was uploaded onto the Open Science Framework, which is an online forum where researchers are often sharing raw data sets with each other, so that way they can kind of more transparently look at each other's research, reproduce.
So, was someone who worked for OkCupid it to
not
the Science Forum?
Not someone who worked for OkCupid. First of all, the Open Science Framework is awesome. It's really cool to be able to share raw data in the name of transparency, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was some Danish researchers who basically scraped all the data off of OkCupid. And this is not actually hard to do. I know, because my plugin, in a sense, does it. It takes advantage of the fact that if you're visiting a profile, you now have the data that's on the profile you're visiting, of course. So like if I visit someone's, if anyone visits anyone else's, if anyone has an account on OkCupid, they can visit anyone else's profile, is what I'm trying to say, right? So you can just kind of keep clicking around and you see all these different people in these different areas. Generally, they're close to you because OkCupid wants to match you with people who are closer to you. But it does kind of raise a question, which is, all of the different people on OkCupid, their profile data is not public per se. It effectively is, because all you need to do is make an account on OkCupid to view any of the data. And the thing that makes this data dump a little bit more problematic is, it's not like you can go and access a bunch of random people's profiles. It's that all of this data is now collected in one easy to download place.
Right.
And then you could do data mining on it. You could identify people.
But this means potentially that their real names and their email addresses were not part of the scrape.
That's true.
Which is kind of nice.
So they are anonymized in that sense, but there have been so many examples that have shown how hard it is to anonymize a data set if you're trying to. This is not trying to anonymize. So the data the data was collected over like a about a year ago, from November 2014 to March 2015, and it includes usernames, ages, gender, religion, personality traits, and also a good number of answers to the questions that OkCupid will ask you, like, do you prefer this or that? What do you want in a partner? All that stuff.
To have more to learn more information about the Chrome extension that Ben has written and works on OkCupid, the show names Pi's Chrome extension uses a unique pin on open hardware, and it was our March 19th, 2016 episode. It is, isn't it?
Yeah. So, in a nutshell, the way my plugin works is, when someone visits someone else's profile, the visitor's browser will go and basically look up all of the questions information. This is all information that the user who's visiting the profile could get just by clicking through to the questions tab. So it's not actually hidden. It's not actually private. It's accessible to the user. All my Chrome extension does is go in, grab that data, and put it on the front page instead of buried behind a tab.
And so somebody did the same kind of thing. They just crawled the entire site, get all the data, and put it up online.
And put
and
it
from
in
a
place.
Science perspective, I mean, if it was actual, if it was a completely anonymized data, that'd actually be pretty useful to know.
But there's no such thing as completely anonymized data.
In fact, listen to your other podcast to listen about that.
Yeah.
We covered about anonymizing data.
Yeah, we covered about anonymizing data and Netflix actually several years ago and some stuff that happened with that. We've got
What's the podcast episode?
I will have to look that up.
Ben does do another podcast, which is fantastic. It's about data science and
it's called Linear Digressions.
Linear Digressions. Okay. Miles? Hidden microphones?
Let's go into more tinfoil hat area.
Oh, I have it for you. It is called Recommendation Engines and Privacy, and it was published on March 28th of this year, so just a month and a half ago.
Cool.
So, back to tinfoil hat.
Back to tinfoil hat.
This comes from CBS San Francisco Bay Area, the local affiliate. They have found that microphones were hidden all around the Bay Area by federal agents.
What?
In public places.
Wait.
Like in parks where people meet with suitcases at night?
Yep, bus stops. And I believe they were even talking about having one at the bus stop outside the Oakland courthouse.
Yeah, that's messed up. So just throwing microphones all over the place? How many of these have been found?
I don't know. It doesn't have that information. But it's quite a few when they start listing off that they put microphones under rocks, they put microphones in trees, they plant microphones in equipment.
Wow.
Makes sense. I mean, the whole
microphones in places that people don't expect to have them, because that's the point.
But that's the whole – if you don't expect it to be there, then that means you can assume privacy at that location.
Right.
Which means
that's
it's not
issue.
Legal.
Right. Well, so, that's the issue that's coming up, and so this will come up with a Fourth Amendment court challenge.
Right. Can you go over the Fourth Amendment idea about search?
Securing your persons and papers against unreasonable search and seizure. So the idea is that a cop can't just go fishing, just like go, well, I don't know exactly if I have, if you have anything bad, but I'm going to go looking anyway to try to find something that is incriminating. Or for that matter, I just want to know what you're doing.
Right.
Even if it's not so much a criminal prosecution.
This
but
domain
more
of the law is similar to if somebody reports that a child might be missing and a cop goes into the house because they heard the child's there, they're not allowed to go look in the dresser, inside drawers of a dresser, because the child couldn't be there. But if something's laying out on the dresser, like a bong or something, then they could go, well, that's seen because of the original case.
See, that's a different thing, because technically the cop could. It's just that nothing they do outside of that constitutional zone would be admissible in court, and then you can have some civil lawsuits with regard to
it. So this becomes a similar thing. If you can assume privacy in a space, but you're being recorded, therefore and there was no search being given, no warrant being given for that privacy invasion, then you could argue that that is private and can't be used in admissible in court, similar to the dresser drawer.
Right. But we're talking about things like, if the microphone is at a bus stop outside the courthouse, that's going to be someone talking to their lawyer and they think that they're alone and it's privileged conversation. I mean, even more so than our own feelings of ick having someone listen to every conversation that we have no matter where we go, there are very overreaching aspects to this.
Yeah. You know, Brian and I listen to Security Now, a great podcast by the Twit Network. And one of the things the security expert is always saying is the only privacy you really have is you go to a park somewhere privately and talk. Then you know you're private. And every time he says that, I think, unless there's microphones in the park. Like, it's this constant.
But I mean, like, who would put microphones in a park under a rock?
And apparently, federal officials, FBI agents.
Oh.
Sad stuff.
I have something that feels a little bit similar.
Was it sad?
It's not FBI, but it's the Philadelphia Police Department who So this computer, this University of Pennsylvania computer and information science professional professor noticed this truck and or this SUV, and it had this really nice big Google Maps logo on it, but it doesn't. I mean, so we're in the Bay Area. We know what a Google Street View car looks like. This does not look like a Google Street View car. It looks like an SUV with a Google Maps sticker stuck on it.
Well, and some other hardware that's near the front, but it doesn't look like the spinning halo up on top that was taking photos for Street View.
Right. So apparently it was a Philadelphia Police Department's vehicle that was parked in the shadows and watching and photographing license plates as the cars drove by, which just feels similar, I guess, to that last story. Like,
actually, there's something to be said for, and I can't obviously can't speak for Google, but it seems very much like this would be an illegal thing to do because you are putting up a company's reputation,
right?
And they were using, allowing for slander. You
know? They were using Google's logo on it.
Logo, yeah, the little Google Maps logo.
Clearly, and trademark Maps infringement.
So just remember, how many years ago was it that Google is? Well, it was fined by, what was the FTC, some government regulation organization, for collecting all the Wi-Fi information as they drive around.
Yeah, that's right.
Which, you know, there's arguments whether it's public or not, but they got slammed for that. They got slammed for that big time. And here is a Google-branded van just sitting there, which is probably the first reason to think it's not actually Google.
Right, those guys drive around.
Yeah, they do.
Also, they're not vans. They're like Priuses, or at least in this area.
Yeah,
they're various vehicles.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Priuses, Lexus, SUVs. I mean, there are a few.
And, you know, this is interesting that it was parked and taking pictures of license plates, because actually the San Jose Police Department, all their squad cars that have cameras on them are always logging license plates.
Well, this isn't a place of high traffic. It was right by the Philadelphia Convention Center's tunnel, so a lot of cars going by.
Okay, so you just park a standard vehicle there to track it.
Yeah, and like, I don't know, if it was just a SUV sitting there, unmarked, I don't know, that doesn't feel nearly as weird as them pretending to be someone else.
Yeah.
Now, as a point of reference, because we covered this in the past on a show 3 or 4 years ago or something like that. Maybe
covered
longer.
What? Oh, covered what?
We covered the scanning of license plates by police car, the passive scanning of that. And there is some data now over time, which is in Oakland, California, the hit rate, in other words, cars that were stolen or wanted for some reason, was just 0.16% of all cars. So it's not exactly an epidemic.
Of cars being stolen?
Yeah, and you have scanned 99.84% of all cars have no issue, but you can track where they are.
But you can use this track information for other purposes.
Right.
In a police investigation, you can find out if somebody's vehicle was at a different location, because there's enough police cars in a city that you can actually find out where vehicles have been.
Or if a nefarious actor compromises the system, then the nefarious actor can do all kinds of stuff with this too.
Miles, on this program, we first heard about this in April of 2009, when we had a police sergeant on the program talking about it. He happened to mention it when we weren't on air, and we both went, "Huh? You're doing what now?" And of course, now it's complete commonplace. Anytime there's a camera that's controlled by a governmental official that's pointed at the roads, it's really easy to pick up every license plate.
Right.
And why wouldn't you?
And we were talking about how it would be a useful service.
Absolutely.
It's just that it has so much room for abuse, because you can't just, you know, scan the license plate and be done with it unless you have these roving data. Like, the mechanism for it is such that you gather all of the license plates and then you look to see, does it get a hit? And to do it so that it doesn't compromise privacy is harder.
Yeah.
And so there's the question of, is it actually being done the hard way, or is it the easy way, which can be compromised?
It's the easy way. You know it's the easy way. It's a Windows 98 machine sitting in a server room.
All right. That was from another show of ours where there was a police department that had run out of space because they were using an old Windows 98 machine.
If you're living near Santa Cruz, come on down to our live event on the 21st of May. That's this Saturday. Learn more and get your free tickets at live.geekspeak.org. Again, that's live.geekspeak.org. Free tickets. And we'd love to see you. A lot of us will be there, and we can chat and say hi, and it'll be fun. All right. I'm speaking with Mr. Ben Jaffe, and Mr. Miles Elam, and Brian Young. Brian, what's up in the Internet of Things world?
The Internet of Things world, the wild, wild west of things. So,
the IoT acronym, which for the longest time I was looking at it going, IoT? What?
I was saying so LOT. LOT? What's LOT?
Right. Internet of Things.
Internet of Things. So, none of you guys are particularly into smart light bulbs, smart home devices. Yeah, that's right. You got you were doing a project on what were those?
But I've also looked at different things that are available and what the limitations are and how big they are and how expensive they are.
He's a geek. He's been researching it.
He's a geek. So I've wanted to do this thing for years. Way back in X10 days, I've wanted to wire up my house. I've never had the money, and mainly I never saw the system that I thought everybody was going to coalesce around and start using to the point where I felt confident I could start investing money into it. Well, I was reading up on, actually listening to that podcast that Lyle mentioned earlier, Security Now, and this kind of blew my mind because Internet of Things devices are cropping up all over the place right now, but this is a great reminder of how early the days it is. There's a protocol a lot of these things use called Zigbee, Zigbee 1.2 specifically.
You mentioned X10.
Yeah.
X10 is a Zigbee protocol device.
Serious?
Yeah, the same thing.
X10 used to always work through the electrical system of your home.
No, they had a wireless protocol as well for the remote controls.
Right, so but it's not the X10 from way back when.
I think it is, folks. I'll be researching this. Go on.
So anyways, Internet of Things, you could have your lights come on at a certain time. This has been done for decades through X10 and other things. You could have your music devices come on when you roll up on the driveway. You could have your garage door open. You could have your door lock connected to it so that through your phone you could unlock your door, or you could have your alarm system hooked up to this in some way.
Or you could have your heater controllable from your phone.
Is there a story there?
Ben has wired up a web interface to his heater at his house. He has a picture on an undisclosed website. You can click on the picture and start his heater, and you can click on it again and stop his heater. And the security protocol for that?
Oh, well, right now...
Obscurity.
I do. No. Right now, I do have a security protocol, but only because you bugged me about it.
Okay, good.
So for the longest time, you could just go to /home and click on the fireplace, and then a little fire GIF would start playing, and my heater at home would turn on and not turn off until you turned it off.
What were you using to control that?
Oh, gosh. Arduino. No, I'm sorry. No.
Wi-Fi, though.
No, there's a little chip that's smaller than Arduino, and it's like a something number, and I can't remember what it's called.
Right. Anyway, go on. And I eat my words, by the way. Zigbee and X10 are not necessarily compatible in any way.
I think you're thinking of X10 and Insteon. Insteon is compatible with X10.
That's what I was thinking. Thank you very much.
Well, here's the thing. There's all these protocols, both wireless and through other means of connecting all of these devices up. And these protocols have been around a while, but manufacturers of devices are using these protocols and apparently not knowing what they're getting themselves into. So if you have any sort of security device, a door lock or a alarm system that's in any way connected through the Zigbee protocol, and this is relatively common with the biggest name brand, which is SmartThings, this protocol is not meant for anything security oriented.
No.
You can completely break into the system and get control over it just because the protocol itself is made for convenience. It's made to easily connect all of these devices. In fact, so much so that if you have a device that's battery operated and doesn't necessarily talk to the control device, the server device that controls it regularly because, you know, it's trying to conserve power, and your credentials change on the system so that it would normally not be able to connect, it'll just let it right on because it's got a protocol for sleepy devices to reconnect that used to be authenticated before. So this is just a word of warning. If you're into these kind of devices and you decided to buy something like a Schlage lock that uses the Zigbee protocol. Even Schlage.
Oh, my God.
Now, like I said, there's multiple protocols, and you may have ways to turn off the Zigbee protocol and use a different one. So look into it. But right now, it is truly the Wild West, and I wouldn't use it for anything other than light bulbs. And
Are there any home automation for lock systems that are safe and secure?
You know, I don't know the full spectrum of possibilities out there, but I do know I like the Apple system that they've been trying to push their
there's no products for
it. Yeah, there's no products for it, because getting something through the system of being approved to use their home automation system is so hard, because it has to be secure, and the chips used for this are higher priced, and it makes the devices
more
expensive.
And they have to be low power, otherwise you're going to run out of batteries, unless you want to plug your door in, which is usually not what people want. And
right.
I think people just need to keep their keys handy for now.
Right.
Or have a wired keypad kind of thing. You could do that. You know, not have it connected to wireless at all. Just have it on the door with a keypad program. Mm-hmm. No.
Or just have a key.
Have a key stuck under the mat.
Or you can get a Raspberry Pi and you can set up some servos and you can make your own protocol through some web page. And
hey,
then
Ben, will you get on that, please?
Sure.
All right, cool. You can click a button to open his house.
I gotta say, back in the early days of the Raspberry Pi, I think the first person who was obsessed with it was you, Miles.
Mm-hmm.
You were just talking about Raspberry Pi all the time, and I'm like, I don't really like Raspberry Pi, but Miles really likes Raspberry, like Pi, the mm-hmm. pumpkin pie, Raspberry Pi, and it took me a little while to realize you were talking about something that was important.
That is really mean, dude.
I didn't mean it that way. Oh, I feel bad now.
So, Miles, you actually have another story about Google Maps, a real Google Maps.
I think I stole his story from him.
Oh, my gosh. No. Same story.
Yeah.
Did you know Phil
that
I
do have another story that has to do with school.
No, you should do the planet story. Oh, no, that is Ben. Oh.
No. I'm going to do the professor of a class. And
Where? Yeah.
Georgia Tech.
Okay.
So to help with a class, and this comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, they hired a teaching a TA known as Jill Watson. And she answered questions online for students and relieved the professor's, you know, overload and what a TA was supposed to do.
Right.
It was not – and he's a computer science professor. It was not until the end of the course – when actually there were some students saying that they wanted to give a recommendation, you know, for outstanding performance to this TA for always being so responsive, and like, was actually an AI.
Yeah, that's awesome. Watson actually tricked me off. Julia Watson?
Jill Watson.
Jill Watson? Okay. So was it using the Watson AI? How do you implement it, or how did she implement it?
It was with the help of students and IBM. So IBM was giving a hand to it, but I don't know how much interaction there was between those two entities.
Interesting. So you actually interacted with you sent an email to this supposed TA, and the TA would respond to you really efficiently and quickly mm-hmm. and help you out. And mm-hmm. actually, it was a computer.
Yeah. Where can I find assignment 2? When is assignment 2 due? In terms of interactions with a TA, things can be fairly rote.
Yeah,
and also the thing is, you can have a question comes in that AI can't handle. And I'm sure it could say, I'll ask the professor about that, automatically send an email. And like, right. Yeah, so there are always ways out. That
is really smart.
Oh, hey. So this person was a friend of mine's research advisor.
Oh, you got to ask.
I'm asking for insider stories right now.
Oh, good.
But I do not have them yet.
All right.
Pending.
Well, are you ready to talk about Kepler?
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm always ready to talk about Kepler. So this is my favorite satellite thing that we put up in orbit and everything. It's a telescope called the Kepler Space Telescope. Is that right? I get it confused with Hubble Space Telescope. I don't know if that's the name, but Kepler satellite. Anyway, basically the thing that the Kepler satellite is trying to do is it's trying to discover planets that are outside of our solar system. So Mercury, Uranus, Neptune, Earth, Mars, all of those are planets that are in our current solar system that we are right now. And these are planets we're looking for that are outside, also called exoplanets. So the way Kepler does this is this method called the occlusion method. And basically it looks at all these different stars and it measures their light output. And if their light output drops and then goes back up, and then after a delay drops again and goes back up, and then drops again and goes back up, then it can actually figure out whether or not there's something moving in front of the star, in between us and the star.
Like a planet.
Occluding the light and making the light output appear to dip, and then go back up when mm-hmm. it goes out of the way. And if you look at the pattern, you can kind of figure out whether it's a planet,
orbital
candidate.
Speed, its size, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And we call these candidate planets because we don't really know. We also kind of guess their distance from the sun, from their star, rather. But there's a really great quote by this person. It says, quote, planet candidates can be thought of like breadcrumbs. If you drop a few large crumbs on the floor, you can pick them up one by one. But if you spill a whole bag of tiny crumbs, you're going to need a broom. So basically, in this case, we've been kind of looking at these candidates one by one to try to analyze them individually and figure out if they're potentially planets. The broom that they're talking about is actually a new method, some software that they wrote, which can automatically look at all of these candidates and do a little bit of a better job of classifying whether they're...
There's lots of points of stars, right? Like the whole point is that if you have to focus in on one and focus on another one, focus on another one. So this is potentially pulling out the focus a bit and actually getting more in the angle?
Or rather, it's analyzing the data at a larger level. Maybe better techniques.
And once again, garbage collection beats manual memory management.
Right.
Does that have a corollary?
Yeah, that's actually something that people talk about. Instead of doing a malloc and then free or a new and delete.
Miles is talking about programming technology, terminologies. But go
on GeekSpeak, we're talking about programming. And one of the things about, for example, Java's garbage collector is that they found that it was many times faster to just do sweep the whole thing, like clean up the entire memory area all in one go rather than having to do the one-off, one-off, one-off.
So isn't that
at the expense of memory?
Isn't that still a debate, though? Okay, so memory, it's memory richer but faster.
Right. It takes up more memory.
Take a brief step back for those who are like, wait, where'd we just go? Which is that garbage collection is the process of cleaning up after yourself in software. So if you create an object that's taking up some memory of your computer, and you create another object, another object, another object, and you're not using those old objects anymore, you can manually remove them, or you can just let the computer sweep up the garbage behind you and kind of do a somewhat more automated job. And what you're saying is the automated way is actually better than having a human do it.
Over time, we find that the automated way beats humans. It used to be like, oh, we're going to code everything in assembly and C is going to be the slower way. And now C compilers can code to modern CPUs so much better than
I feel like you've
human.
Opened up a giant box of things to argue about, but we'll let that go. I'll just say that Kepler, in the Wikipedia entry, Kepler is a space observatory launched by NASA to discover Earth's planets orbiting the other stars. The spacecraft, named after the Renaissance astronomer Johannes Kepler, was launched on March 7th, 2009, into an Earth-trailing heliocentric orbit.
And ever since then, I've been talking about it constantly.
Yes, you have.
Because I love this satellite. Also, I just want to read this other pretty cool quote. Which is a quote, and this is, by the way, there's a researchers from Princeton, and they wrote that Vespa, which is the software package, computed the reliability values for over 7,000 signals identified in the latest Kepler catalog, which identified 4,302 potential planets, verified the 1,284 planets that we already know about with 99% certainty, and they also independently verified more than 700 additional planet signals that have already been confirmed as planet by other methods. So basically, this thing is really reliable, pretty reliable.
You have 700 more episodes of GeekSpeak to mention. You can mention one of those planets on every episode.
Do we have we have a lot more than 700? Wait,
from here on out, you could just every episode you could
That's a good point.
Because it used to be that every time they launched discovered a planet, you'd be like, hey, they found a planet.
Yeah, and it's called U87994 Alpha or whatever it is.
Ah, cool.
And also, in addition, the researchers identified 824 candidates as likely false positives. So things we thought were thought were real, but they actually might be false positives. It's just really kind of cool. The last thing is they found that in this newly validated batch of planets, nearly 550 could be rocky planets like Earth, and 9 of them orbit in their sun's habitable zone, which is the distance, the zone, the Goldilocks zone, we call it, where liquid water might exist, which means life as we understand it might exist. So ultimately awesome. And this is from... This is from a spacecraft that was in emergency mode a couple weeks ago because it had some problems and nobody knew if it was going to come back. So
cool.
Space exploration is a wild world.
Yay, software. Hey, Brian, got some information about emojis by chance?
You know what's harder than software engineering?
What's that?
Social engineering.
Oh, this is true.
I don't know. Some people are pretty stupid.
Hey, wait a second. So it was in 2015 that the Unicode organization decided to come out with trying to correct a problem of apparent racism in emoji by coming out with the various skin colors available in the emoji set. So you could then no longer have to choose a white hand or one of the many other emoji. You could choose any shade of skin color from white to dark brown. And then they also made the Simpsons yellow the default skin color for these emoji.
So are these emojis actually different emoji for the different skin tones, or are they an alteration of it?
They're different in the Unicode definition in the set, but they're all the same symbol. So you simply can identify the skin color that you prefer to identify.
So a combination character.
So if you're in iOS and you've turned on the emoji character set, which is in your keyboards, and you hold down on some of these characters, you can actually get a choice of different color sets to use. Yellow being the default, and then it goes from a very pale white to a very dark brown of like five different choices or something like that. And a whole bunch of the characters in the emoji set work this way. The thumbs up, the smiley face, things like that.
So I actually thought it was fun to start using multiple skin colors. I tend to change it all the time now, partly because I just think it's fun, and partly because I thought, well, there's plenty of white in the world. So, Miles, yep. I'm just curious. Is that at all offensive to somebody who is a minority in our country as far as skin color?
Okay, first of all, I don't speak for all minorities.
No.
But I do choose the thumbs up that is closest to my skin color.
I actually did
that because I could. Like, you know, why not?
Yeah, why not?
Because once I choose it, it's there. I don't have to reselect it each time. So it's not like it's a burden, which actually would be just as bad as if you had to.
Right. If it defaulted to a particular color and then you had to choose every single time.
In the grand scheme of racial disparity in or ethnic disparity within our society or with regard to power and class structure, I don't think emoji ranks anywhere, anywhere important. But it's one of those cases where if you're going to do it, why not keep those ideas in mind? Like, it wasn't something that I would have walked and marched on Washington for. But at the same time, it is an example of privilege, of white privilege, and the fact that they addressed that, I thought, was just a good sign that people are thinking about the problem.
Exactly. But at the same time, people have been examining the skin tones used on Twitter and finding how minorities are far better represented on Twitter now, in fact, overly represented, which...
you mean the character sets of like the yellow smiley face being white or different shades of brown?
Can you do that with the smiley face?
I don't know if you can do the smiley. Let me check.
I know you can do it with of the hand symbols.
Let's say the hand symbol. The thumbs up symbol can be yellow or five different shades of pink to brown coloring. So you're saying that if you look at that character or those variations of character, there's more in different ranges? And then in the default yellow.
Right. Yeah, the darker skin tones get more representation now than white skin tones, which I think is fantastic, which probably means, assuming that an American demographic, that lots of people of different skin colors are using ones that don't represent their own skin color. But this has become a bit of a row around the internet, as everything does. And I was reading this article about all of this, and the upshot of this article was, well, if you're white, it would be racist to use another skin tone because shouldn't you leave that for those people who felt underrepresented before so they could choose the skin color they identify with?
And once again, maybe technically you could make that argument, but on this grand scheme of things that kind of goes below, I should clean the brush in front of my house to make sure no one gets a thorn. You know, like, it's just...
low priority is what you're saying.
Yeah,
definitely.
But then again, if you are white and you choose a white emoji or even a yellow emoji, which is labeled in the Unicode as white, even though, you know, it's Simpson's yellow, then of course you're being racist then as well. So if you're white and you're using emoji, then you're being racist.
Yeah. There is something about emojis that is odd with regard to skin color, which is that Unicode refers to a glyph as an idea, a concept.
Yes.
Not its rendering.
That's right.
That's why you can have a G that's in sans serif versus a serif font, or, you know, Comic Sans, or versus,
all of them can look different depending on the platform, because the description is things like boy holding lollipop.
Right.
Like, that's all you got, right? So you can draw it any way you want.
So with that, the skin color on emojis tends to break that. But then again, emojis are a different thing. So it's really hard to grasp or to get a handle on. Whereas the letter G in the Latin alphabet is, you know, just a G. We know that it doesn't matter what skin color the person has or what gender they are or what sexual orientation. It's just a G. There is nothing charged about it. Emoji was brought in because nonverbal communication, in other words, something not based upon writing, even though emojis are written down,
right,
is a very large part of conversation. And then once you get into that in people's faces, then don't you have to address the fact that who you're talking to has context, and, you know, who is speaking and what skin color they have does have context in our society. It's meet space is always hard.
Well, after years and years of trying to express myself through email and then text messaging and continually failing, I just feel this is right in line with the rest of my history.
Just failing to be communicative.
Yeah, clearly. Exactly.
So the emoji, the emoji color set we're talking about is the modifier Fitzpatrick, type 3 to type 6, being darker at the 6 level. And you can actually modify a whole bunch of the different character sets. This is all from the emojipedia.org if you want to learn all about emojis, which is kind of cool. A lot more than I thought of, like the person folded hands, the prayer one, all the hand symbol ones, but also like the skier and the snowboarder, the bathtub person.
Except the hand ones may not be prayer, because we've had a show talking about how it was always ambiguous. So that's it could just be someone clapping.
That's why the description of it is person with folded hands. Which is
folded hands.
It says folded hands. It says not the version of the person with folded hands emoji has the, let's see.
Which would be the person who's pantomiming a book.
So person with folded hands. Two hands placed firmly together, meaning please or thank you in Japanese culture. Other common uses of this character include prayer, praying hands, or a high five. A previous version of this emoji displayed a yellow burst of light behind the two hands on iOS.
So in other words, it can mean anything.
They can all mean anything. Absolutely.
I got to say, covering emojis on the radio.
A new low.
No, actually, this also makes sense, too, because what looks like the same character in English is not the same character in other languages, not the same pronunciation, or the letter may not exist.
If you think this is a silly conversation, let's listen to Miles' computer game story.
Uh-oh.
Well, there's a couple of computer game stories. Which one do you want? Battlefield 1. It's a recent edition of the Battlefield series. It started off with Battlefield 1942, and then there was Battlefield 2. And
what is this show about?
It's a
game about.
It's a war simulator, first person shooter, war simulation. And Battlefield 1, the reason it's called 1, even though it's not the first one in the series, is because it's covering World War 1.
This
is Battlefield 1942 covered World War 2.
So they kind of, there's a brick wall in front of them, unless,
you mean a trench wall? Yeah. The thing is, history buffs have gone into, looked at the trailer, the game hasn't been released yet, to see.
Oh, if they're accurate?
Yeah, how accurate it is. And there are some things that are wrong. There's some, for example, some weapons that are in the hands of different groups than they would have been.
Meaning like a certain weapon would have been allocated to a certain group unit.
And well, no, a certain weapon would have been associated with a particular country.
Okay.
And it was – but at the same time, it may be entirely possible in Battlefield 1 that you could pick up the weapon of someone who dropped. Right. That's been something that's a thing.
A game like this being historically accurate, is that really...
But
like,
they did have, for example, tanks and Zeppelins as they moved. The Zeppelins were moving exactly the way that Zeppelins did at the time.
Cool, cool.
And were being used in the same ways.
The thing I meant about there's a brick wall in front of you is you can only release two versions of the game because we haven't had a World War III yet.
That's what you meant.
And let's hope that stays the same.
Well, they also have Battlefield Vietnam.
Okay, so they're basically throwing the number out there.
Got a lot of wars.
Okay.
A lot of wars.
Never mind. Yeah. My point is...
I think there's actually a Turn of the Century one, too. Or I mean, a Dark Ages one. Like
a Dark Age? Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that would probably be the Golden Horde, or the Mongols taking over.
So potentially that game is not as historically accurate as it could be.
On the contrary, it seemed like it was fairly accurate. There were some discrepancies, but as far as games go, entertainment, a lot of times you don't look for accuracy in it. And it actually raised a question for me saying, I wish that there were more games out there that did bring in aspects, were more didactic, that had more educational aspects to them. That as I listened to my history podcast, wow, this is a great story. Why don't they make a movie out of this? Like, you don't even have to do anything. Like, it would be so much intrigue and greatness that we have to look for all these fictional stories, but all these stories that are even crazier than what we have showing up on TV or you know, on movies, on the movie screen, existed. They actually happened.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great to entertain us with actual historical knowledge?
So – thank you, Miles, for that. You're listening to Geekspeak. That's Miles. I'm speaking with Ben and also Brian. Brian, you have something that hasn't actually happened. You showed me some video work of something that blew me away, and I think the geeks have to see this as you describe it.
So, okay, so this is another one of those stories that we never should cover on radio, except for it's just too darn cool. Okay, so years and years ago, I'm sorry. I'm not going to give history in this case. I'm going to describe exactly what the geeks are looking at right now.
Okay.
There's three images up there.
Three videos.
One is of a scruffy-looking guy just making faces to the camera.
He's just hanging out, and he's on a... It looks like he's just in some room or something.
Another is former President George W. Bush just sitting there with a expressionless face, kind of like you expect he might be doing, waiting for an interview to ask him questions. Maybe
this is kind of a video loop where his head is kind of moving back and forth a little bit, like he's looking around the room, but he doesn't move his mouth.
No, he's pretty much giving no expression at all. And then on the third video that's playing is the expressions from that person in the upper left, that scruffy-faced individual, making all sorts of just facial expressions that are actually showing up on George W. Bush's face.
So he is George Bush's face, but his expressions are coming through onto George Bush's face.
Exactly. George
it
Bush
really
opens
good.
His mouth
he's
just
like
just like the man in the scruffy face man is opening his mouth.
So it's now, like, now, from a perspective of like motion picture graphics and lots of time and the stuff your wife does of actually animating like Gollum and having everything work on a digital face, totally been doable for a long time.
No,
the reason why this is really, really different is what?
This is live. This is real time. There is a technology going on here that in an instant is creating a model of the face of the person who's making the faces and grabbing the image of the face of the person who's being manipulated and then putting that image on that 3D graphical model and then compositing it back onto the face of, in this case, the former president. So this is all happening live, and this is just video footage, not special video footage of George W. Bush that they took from somewhere. It is right off of YouTube.
Right, right. They haven't taken like George W. Bush and scanned him in a 3D scanner and figured out his facial or anything. They're just taking a live video of a human being, another live video of a human being, and moving the emotion and face. And in fact, he actually opens his mouth. And the mouth movement looks pretty accurate.
Now,
well, there's a little bit off. It's kind of hitting that uncanny valley. But
that's what I was going to ask you guys. Can you tell right away that it's fake?
With Donald Trump, I couldn't. With George W. Bush, I could.
Yeah. Is that saying more about the person than the technology?
Who knows? But at the same time, like it.
So with this kind of technology, how will we know that anything is real? Like.
Well, you could say the same about Photoshop, and that's been around for ages.
Yeah,
this is just Photoshop. Right, version. But this Photoshop can be done in real time, and
yeah, think of it.
You're going to be having a whole bunch of people putting these up, like having Obama say something, whatever, or right. have Hillary Clinton say something totally inflammatory just before an election, and it doesn't matter if it gets refuted and people say it's a fake.
So I didn't say the question was a bad question.
Thank you.
Oh. I just said we've had this with Photoshop for a long time, and ultimately what happened was people will just respond to a photo. I mean, you post a photo and some people will be like, oh my God, did that really happen? Some people will be like, that's totally Photoshopped, you know? So, I mean, as a culture, I think we won't know what to do at first, but then eventually we will adapt. Also, this technology is already in people's phones already. Like there are actually a number of companies who do similar things to this. This is kind of in a research phase and it's a little bit different. But I know that there's a company called Masquerade that does this where you can put you and your friend in front of the camera on your phone, and it'll swap your faces and, you know, get the expressions right and everything.
It's that of course actually is slicing out the one face and putting it into the other face, so the look of the look of the final looks like a mash of two people, which
but
is
regardless
kind of with you.
But regardless, it does understand kind of where your features are and and how to interact with them and everything, so we're getting closer and closer.
Just to talk about technology here for a moment, there have been plenty of systems that do this exact thing for a while. I think Apple bought a company called PrimeSense that was made for this, or something very similar. And there are other companies like that use cameras that get depth information. It's not just an image, but it also can grab the depth of what the image is. So you can tell the distance from the camera and therefore make a 3D model. What's really incredible about this technology is it's using just off-the-shelf video cameras, just web cameras, and it's able to do this. So it's commodity hardware all the way around, and it's fast, and it does make it so that live footage no longer is trustworthy unless you're going to look for every little detail of those facial quirks. In fact, this does a really good job with inside the mouth as well, which is extraordinary, because other systems actually build a fake model of inside the mouth, and this one is using image interpolation and other things to produce what looks much more realistic.
Amazing stuff. Thank you. And we can find out more about that and see the videos and stuff, of course, from geekspeak.org. And today's the episode 20, season 16, or also the May 18th episode. This one we'll put it up. And I think we're going to cover one more story. Miles, you've got software solves mystery or the world's perfect game?
Oh, decisions.
Let's do the mystery.
Sure. There's an old poem by Sappho, the Greek poet, and the thing was the poem was kind of broken up. They didn't know exactly when it was written because you have to interpolate, like, what is this type of speech that's being used? Does that fit this era versus this era?
Yeah, there's no dates. There's no dates like inscribed below
date
it.
Date your paper. Every time you have paper,
date your paper.
So it talks about the night sky and the way that it looks. So software simulated the night sky to figure out when it was written.
How much description's in the night sky?
How much change is there in the night sky?
Actually, I take this back. This wasn't which year. This is actually what time of year. I'm sorry.
What time of year? That's fine. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So the seasonal description.
Yes.
From a certain era or a certain location on Earth. Cool. Huh. That's pretty awesome that you've been able to do that. And how old is this poem?
2,500 years old.
25 years old.
So, did it place the location or they already knew the location?
They already knew the location. I mean, pretty much.
This reminds me of Neil deGrasse Tyson complaining to James Cameron about Titanic and how they got all the details right, except they had the wrong night sky.
Right.
And they knew what the night sky should look like on the night of the sinking of the Titanic. It should be easy to do, but they composited in the wrong night sky. And so he complained about it, and it actually got fixed in the redone version.
But not the redone is not the original?
The redone is not the original. But it's the right one.
But James Cameron, before fixing it, then responded to Neil deGrasse Tyson when he mentioned the error. This movie made over $1 billion in the box office. Now imagine how much it would have made if we made the night sky correct.
Right.
deflated him. But
he did change it eventually.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff anyway you'd like it. Just let them know. We say hi. Thanks to our intern, Chandler. Our support geek, Greg Merkley, who provided this week's title, kids caught on mic reading Kepler's poem. The theme song is by Michael Newman. Thank you so much, and thank you all for participating on the 20th episode of our 16th season. And Brian and Ben and Miles, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to you, too.
See you next week. Okay, tell us about the Donkey Kong thing. I cannot know about the Donkey Kong thing.
So, first of all, did we rush through that?
What?
How long?
The end?
How long was that show?
57 minutes.
No kidding.
Well, I started a little later, so it's probably a little longer.
With no reference point, I thought that was a half an hour.
Oh, really? No, this thing has 57.20.
Oh, I thought it was an hour and a half.
I don't know when I think I had like 2 minutes of pre-recording, so we're about right time on the show.
Not the bad.
Okay. So the story about Donkey Kong is that Pac-Man, that people have had a perfect score on before and some other ones, it's very deterministic. You can figure out a way to, you know, every time you get a power pellet, you get all four ghosts, you get every single piece, you get every single piece of
fruit. Or you're talking about playing the perfect game.
Yes.
I don't have a clue what you're talking about. Okay. You get all four ghosts?
Yeah.
Pac-Man. He switched to Pac-Man while you were beatboxing to Donkey Kong.
Oh.
So.
Now I understand all of it.
Pac-Man. Yeah, okay. We're going.
Donkey Kong, on the other hand, isn't deterministic like that. They're not sure how many points you can get. Every few years, someone hypothesizes a way that you can do it. Someone will beat what was seen to be as the theoretical best you could have.
Right. Is there like a randomness element to it or something?
Well, there is the ability to do something where you could get a over 2 million points. The highest that anyone's ever gotten is about 1.2 million. So you could get over 2 million, but the only way you would be able to do so is a tedious frame-by-frame analysis and save-state-driven manipulation of the game's random number generation, which would never be possible for a human player.
So if you were to perfectly set up a situation where the random number generator was giving you a random value that was the highest possible, you could potentially do that by knowing the frame count.
Well, that and you could – the random number generator for Donkey Kong is not perfect. So you could do a frame-by-frame analysis and game like what the random number generator was going to give you next and then figure out what you were going to do next. Mm. It's just that it would require frame-by-frame analysis and require reflexes that are beyond human ability.
It would also require perfect execution of that. Like you couldn't put that all in memory. You'd have to slow it down. Okay, go on.
Right.
I mean human memory.
It was something I didn't know about Donkey Kong, which is that people have been trying to get the perfect game of Donkey Kong, and every time they've been doing something where like you either wouldn't run out of lives. Actually, the best way to do it apparently is on a level just before the kill level at the end, you lose some lives so you can do this really high point total rack up.
Lose a point ever until the second to last screen.
Right.
And then,
which is like a bonus screen where you're jumping over 20 billion
barrels
and right. then bumping up points.
So you purposely redo the bonus screen over and over and over again with as many lives as you can muster.
And then you have to finish the game without dying.
After that. I mean, well, all of these. I mean, the Pac-Man one that you're talking about is a perfect game where you never lose any lives, and you run out until the memory space of the game fails, where you actually run into a point where your game can't go higher than that. Because
it's probably garbage collected.
Yeah, effectively it is. The last couple levels become – you can't actually read the screen because the integers are too high. They max out, and the game like starts to break in this weird ways. But you can still play it. You just can't see what you're playing. But in any case, so Donkey Kong – have they gotten to a new theoretical best win, or has someone gotten to a point where they have beat the theoretical, or they have gotten the best?
A person by the name of Copeland, looking for his first name here, Wes Copeland,
not Aaron Copeland,
no,
the famous,
Wes Copeland got 1,218,000 points, but what they're finding is at that level, it's as much about luck as it is about skill. You have to be skillful and be able to do everything you're supposed to and be able to jump over, you know, triple barrels and
you have
that.
To have some help from the random number generator.
And then you have to just have some luck at the draw.
Yeah, interesting.
So when's somebody going to hook this up to Watson and see what Watson can do?
Well, I mean, that'd be about as useful as making Watson play a game of Jeopardy. I mean, no one's ever going to do that.
Hey, Ben, why didn't you want us to talk about the Oracle versus Google?
Oh, because APIs. I'm horrible at those kinds of stories.
How so?
At least I feel like I'm horrible. I get all the technical terms wrong and everything, but yeah, here it goes. So Oracle, okay, this is the story in which Miles is going to constantly correct me, because this is what always happens.
Do you want me to do the story instead?
No, it'd be a lot more fun if you just constantly correct me.
Okay.
So as I understand, Oracle is suing Google for the use of their APIs, their Java APIs in Android, which is particularly problematic because APIs should not be copyrightable. What?
This is what the case is deciding, is whether or not they are copyrightable.
Oh, no, I'm stating an opinion right now.
Yeah. APIs, just to make it clear.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that and say that's my opinion, but it's the right answer. APIs should not be copyrightable.
Application programming interface.
Right, basically it's the interface that you have to a program, to a service, to something.
Let's put it this way. You have a car, and you have no idea really how your car works if you're like 99% of us.
Right.
You don't know the internal workings, how the software works with regard to the steering wheel and stuff like that, and what the braking force is. What type of brake pads you have.
Right.
You don't know any of these things.
All kinds of stuff under the hood, literally, that you don't have access to. Really.
And they are different between a Lexus SUV and a Mazda Miata.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And at the same time, you can drive both a Lexus SUV and a Mazda Miata.
I have not tried either, but I would put money that I could.
Because they have the same API. An accelerator pedal, a brake pedal, a gear shift, the turn signal, steering wheel.
In fact, you can think of manual shifting transmission vehicles as one version of an API, mm-hmm. and the
like
automatic
one, slightly lower API. Level API, yeah.
And the second one is another version of the API. And some people only learn one API, so they're not good at the clutch. And that would be me.
I can't drive a stick. No, I can't. Yeah. Does anyone have a stick that they want me to like?
But this is how computers work. You have something that's a description of what you want done. And in gaming, it could be something like collision detection. Does this thing collide with this other sprite?
Right.
Or it could be something like, what is the cosine of this value? Or it could just be,
So your argument would be that in a programming world, having copyright on the API does not make any sense.
Having a copyright on the implementation, that's totally fine. The implementation being
the way
that a Mazda or a Lexus or whatever, mm-hmm. the way that they actually implement this API and make it so that way when you turn the steering wheel left or right, the car actually goes left or right. Like all of that stuff, that could be proprietary information. That could be, whatever. It could be copyrightable. I'm totally fine with that. But to say that having a steering wheel and using, like, to have that be the copyrightable thing feels very wrong to me.
I have another analogy that would be really wonderful. Haikus.
Can
you copyright a haiku? Sure. Can you copyright the syllabic meter associated with haikus? Because that's your API. That's what makes them all haikus.
Right. Yeah, so that's another good example. So this story is kind of about how the jury does not understand this whole world.
No, that's a bad idea. That's bad that they don't understand.
So they're basically making a decision on a case that they fundamentally don't understand.
Well, neither the jury nor the judge.
Yeah, that's a good clarification. So different people over the course of this case have been trying to explain what an API is, and it's really kind of depressing. Like here's a quote from the article. It says, Eric Schmidt sought to describe APIs and languages using power plugs as an analogy. Jonathan Schwartz tried his hand at explaining with breakfast menus, only to have Judge William Alsup respond witheringly, "I don't know what the witness just said. The thing about the breakfast menu makes no sense." So, okay, maybe it was a bad metaphor, right? So then he tried again, and here's another quote from the article a little bit later. Schwartz's second attempt at the breakfast menu analogy went much better, as he explained that although two different restaurants could have hamburgers on the menu, the actual hamburgers themselves were different. The terms on the menu were an API, and the hamburgers were implementation.
Oh, that's a bad metaphor to use.
It's a bad metaphor.
Because, of course, a menu right away is a copyrightable thing. It's written. You know, it's like,
right.
Language is a better way of saying this. You can't copyright French. Right, you can do all these things in French. You can't copyright it. It's a language.
Yeah.
And APIs are some more similar to that than normal things. But I have to say that it's very challenging because it's very true that in IP law, if you will, trademarks, processes in trademarks can be protected. Right. That process in trademarks. And normally, copyrights are more loose and easier for the copyright holder than trademarks. Trademarks, you have to prove more, and yet trademarks have the ability for process. Mm-hmm. So it seems like if trademark is actually a more strict form and has that capability, you'd kind of assume that copyright would also cover those kind of processes.
I do have a couple of thoughts about this. So I kind of started being critical of judges and the jury, but also it must really suck to be a judge having these bad metaphors thrown at you, you know? Like, if you don't understand somebody or something, it's kind of up to the people in the courtroom to explain it to you in a way that you can understand well enough that you can make a decision about it, right?
So I read that same article. It's a very entertainingly written article.
Yeah.
And it's a little hard to read through if you're a geek and you do understand these things, because it paints a pretty grim picture that the world is being decided by people that don't understand our world.
Right.
At the same time, there's another article I read, which was...
I was actually thinking the layman may make the exact same argument.
Uh-huh. Right.
In what way?
People who don't understand coding are having their world defined by coders.
Well, yeah, and it was like the last 20 years has been defined by technology
but that's reality. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I remember in the 90s, people, and especially around the .com 2000s, people were saying, well, the geeks have won. The geeks have taken over. The geeks are now running our world.
At us now, recording a podcast in a dark room. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, but you read this article and it paints the picture of, no, now it's the normal's time to get revenge on the geeks.
Oh, geez.
But yeah, that's just an entertaining framing. But what I was also reading was a article written by the, Michael Hussey. I hope I got his name pronounced properly there. He used to work at Oracle, and he was a senior software developer manager, and he's also a copyright lawyer. Anyways, he has a take that I think you should read, not that you have to agree to, but he makes the case that this is the way it should be, and that APIs are copyrightable, and if somebody's going to use that API, to replicate that API, they're going to have to get licensing from the original publisher of the API. Because in his opinion, this fits squarely in copyright law, because copyright is supposed to help the creative aspect of writing.
Well, so the interesting thing about this, if you do take it that copyright should cover APIs, then we have a giant problem with Java. Because if you copyright that, all of a sudden there's a – I guess Oracle just owns a lot more of the world. I guess is how you have to think about it, right? Because it becomes a serious problem. We've done so much new development based off of that API that it's more like a language. Like all of a sudden saying, no, all those poems you have to pay me for because you wrote them in French.
Well, no. They're not saying that if you call that particular method or that function, if you use that API in your code, they're not saying that you're going to have to then pay Oracle or that Oracle owns the use of that. They're saying if you want to replicate that, if you want to make another version of Java that uses those same names and has different implementation underneath, that's what you can't do. That's what's copyrighted. So
if you want to make a dishwasher that has a door on the front and has racks for you to put the washer in, but it doesn't wash in the same way once you close the door, you can't do that because we own the concept of a dishwasher.
And this gets even more crazy when you start talking about really normal English words that are used for API names that are completely discoverable.
Big integer, big decimal.
In fact, they're meant to be discoverable. That's why people write them in that way, so everybody can figure them out.
The whole point of the API is to make it self-explanatory, right? So you're going to use simple terminology that is easy to discover. Therefore, it isn't unique. You know, it's kind of like...
Or creative.
Right. Man, I didn't know that the idea was that only implementations using the API would be copyright infringed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the case
seems
is about
a little darker.
Oracle owns Java after they bought it from Sun.
Yeah,
get that
sure.
right.
Uh-huh.
And Google to make Android. Actually, this is back when they were Danger, I believe. They re-implemented Java, and they used many of the same names. Not entirely, though, from what I understand.
Wouldn't this be the case that Linux would be, or GNU would be, an illegal threat as well?
I was actually thinking in terms of if this were allowed to pass, and Oracle prevails in this case, it would mean that all of the progress that has been made in computers for the last, let's say, 30 years would have been wiped out, because the clones of IBM PCs that were made by Compaq and the like would not have been possible. Yeah. You could not have reverse engineered the BIOS to get programs to run because that is an API.
So that's where this article that we'll also include on the site comes into play, because he says, yeah, it essentially is like the hardware argument of making the IBM PC clone. You would have to start re-implementing things in a clean room and prove that these software engineers were only given a spec without any prior knowledge of what the API they're re-implementing was. And if that's the case, if we're going to go that direction, there's all kinds of things out there that fall down, and all sorts. If you think the patent trolls of now are hideous to look at, it's going to be the same kind of thing for copyright. People are going to start lawsuits left and right about this very same thing.
Whether, you know, range search is, you know, is my quicksort a different API than your quicksort?
Mm-hmm. What's the Linux library that allows you to run Windows programs?
Wine.
Yeah. Wine would certainly have the same problem if Microsoft came after an open source implementer.
Well, I mean, even the commands in Linux, like cd, which is a change directory command, comes from Unix, right? So when that was first written, it was in Unix, and then when Linus did a total report of Unix and called it Linux,
he
didn't do the kernel.
When
the GNU project did a re-implementation of all the what are they called, the built-ins, I guess, is what they're called. When those were done, they used the same names. They implemented them whatever they implemented, but
and
they used
the
same names.
Thank goodness, because, I mean, whenever I end up on a DOS box, which thank goodness doesn't happen very often, I can't remember how to change directories or list the things in the directories or rename files or any of that stuff. Like, I have this set of knowledge, which is this API, basically, and everyone, like all of you and everyone else I work with, has this set of knowledge. And so we all have an intuition about how to interact with computers, with services, and these things all kind of lean on each other in a way.
So let's say that this court, let's say it's true that the interface, the API themselves, these names are actually copyrightable. The side effect of that would be a rebirth of an operating system, rebirth of programming languages that would in the very beginning make that open public domain, that API. Like, I'm making a new programming language. This API is public domain, right? And so as soon as you do that, then you kind of let people develop it. And wouldn't this just kind of promote
other
languages?
If the API is based upon logical human language as closely as possible, then the most clear and concise way of stating it is going to be the one that's first. And if it's by a for-profit company, it is by definition making every other API for a competing language or whatever have to be less clear.
Right.
Right.
Even though the obvious path for clarity.
So if you have a string, a character, a bunch of letters, and you want to do string.sort or array.sort, and that's the first implementation, and it's by a company who doesn't open this up to everybody else, then basically, if I want to implement some kind of an array sorting, I can't name it benarray.sort. Well, I have to name it benarray.organize things.
I think one way to think of this is, of course, we have a lot of these terminologies collide at different namespaces. That's a very common thing. So it's really the one-time implementation that does all the things that another one does, which is the problem, right?
But
you could probably do 50% of Java and have the other 50 things be called something else, and
but
you wouldn't be infringing.
But how do you know that they wouldn't come after you? Like, where's that line?
Sure.
You know, like, what if you do 80%? what if you do all of the important ones that everyone uses every day, but all of the things that nobody uses, you don't implement, or you implement differently?
Totally.
Yeah.
What if
it's not the API? What if it's the keywords used in the language, which are very common among C, C++, Java, JavaScript, C Sharp?
And just to throw this out there, something from John Gruber, Daring Fireball, he made a comment. So Google, one of Google's arguments is if they had to make their operating system built around a language that nobody had ever used before and that was not common, it would have been much harder for them to get adoption of their platform and to get all of these apps written and stuff like that, which is unfortunately not a great argument in this case because their main competitor is Apple, which whose language of Objective-C was pretty much in obscurity at that time when the platform came out and was able to gain adoption despite those odds. So what I'm worried about is that Google doesn't have the right perspective in approaching the jury and the judge in order to champion this idea.
And that is the biggest danger, the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity.
Yeah, right, which hopefully we can do bridging a little bit. This actually brings us exactly back to kind of my main point here is that not only do the judges and jury not really understand the technical world that they're largely shaping with this decision, whichever way they rule, but also, like the people on the geek side, really have to do a better job communicating. I mean, ultimately, part of their job is education, right? And if they can't communicate this using using clear metaphors that make sense and don't fall down if you push on them, then how can anyone expect the judge and jury to make any kind of either good or bad, I guess, reasonable decision, regardless of how they feel about it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me on CodeSpeak today. I appreciate it.
CodeSpeak.
No, wait a second. Speaking of CodeSpeak, are you sure garbage collection is that much better? Isn't it about trade-offs? Isn't engineering about trade-offs?
It is about trade-offs. But at the same time, if you're looking at just pure memory performance or pure computing performance, calling malloc and free over and over again, or new and delete over and over again, to use the C and C++ analogs, garbage collection is faster.
Okay, in that limited way, as long as you define the problem only in that way.
Well, as far as memory management is concerned, garbage collection is faster.
But in a real-world system, maybe memory is important.
Well, yes. I mean, if you're...
I was just taking umbrage to your declaration that absolutely better.
I thought I was talking about memory management performance, but okay. That's, yeah.
That's what I thought you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Maybe I just misheard.
We good?
Yeah, now we're done with CodeSpeak.
All right. See you next week.